Within the last week or so, two major news organizations, NBC News and the Los Angeles Times, have begun using the term civil war to describe the conflict in Iraq. And this has touched off a fair amount of debate in the journalistic community among reporters. Also in Washington, with members of Congress and the administration weighing in on the question of whether or not what's going on in Iraq can be fairly called a civil war. So we thought it would be interesting to talk a little bit about just how it is one defines civil war and ask that question. Does indeed this label fit what is going on in Iraq? Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is a political scientist who has spent a lot of time studying the politics of civil wars. He is James Fraun. He's professor of political science at Stanford University and has written a lot on the subject and its many aspects. Testified before the Congress just a couple of months ago in September on this very subject, and we're pleased that he could be spending some time with us in this first hour of the show. He's joining us by telephone. As we talk, questions, of course, are always welcome. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people are brief as they can be, just so that we can keep the program moving, get in as many different callers as possible. But, of course, people who are listening are welcome to join the conversation. In Champaign-Urbana, here where we are, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that means if it would be a long-distance call for you, use the toll-free line, and we will pay for the call, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Fraun, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
I think that to begin, I suppose, as you did when you were talking with members of Congress back in September, the place to start is to talk a little bit about just what we mean when we say something is a civil war, what qualifies. And I think, as you pointed out, what's perhaps difficult for people here in the United States as they think about Iraq is that for us, our point of reference is our civil war, which I gather is in some respects not typical of other civil wars, at least those that we have seen in the post-World War II era. So, having said all that, if I ask you the question, what is the basic definition of civil war? What is it?
Well, I think it's pretty straightforward, and it would covers fairly easily both the U.S. Civil War and a lot of the conflicts we've seen that typically are described in, say, the U.S. media as civil wars since 1945. And that would be, it's a civil war is a conflict between a violent conflict within a country between organized groups who are fighting either to take power at the center of the country or to take power in a region, either increased autonomy or secession, or in some cases fighting in an attempt to use violence to force a change in some major government policy. So the U.S. Civil War would qualify on the grounds of large organized groups fighting, in that case, over a question of secession in Iraq. I would say that there's been a civil war since probably we can go back to sometime in 2004 on the grounds that you have since then Sunni insurgent groups fighting with an intention of forcing a change in certainly a major change in government policies. And plausibly as well, just to depose the Shiite-dominated government.
Mm-hmm. I think that there are many cases where we could look at a place where we have said this is a civil war and seen that the number, as a proportion of the population, the number of combatants may be relatively small, that it might involve small numbers of people who are actually doing the fighting, although a lot of the civilian population ends up being killed because they're the ones that are caught in the crossfire, literally and figuratively. Is there some sort of rule of thumb that one might apply to this kind of conflict that says once we reach a certain threshold of number of people killed or of number of combatants, then it becomes clear, but when it's less than that, that maybe it's more debatable? Or does that not even does playing that kind of game with numbers, is that really not even important?
it's tricky. So I think that if you have a conflict where only 10 or 20 people are killed, it's that doesn't fit with what we normally think of as a civil war, or would want to use that term to describe. So we'd want to say, oh, that's terrorism, or use some other term than civil war. So there has to be a threshold somewhere, but exactly where you put it in terms of the scale of the violence is ultimately a somewhat arbitrary distinction. But it's like the saying about night and day. The fact of dusk doesn't mean you can't, there's no difference between night and day. And so at some point, the violence is clearly at a level where we'd say, oh yeah, that's big enough that we call it a civil war. Academics like myself, who study civil war, tend to use what I think most people would consider a pretty low threshold of 1,000 dead total. But we do that just so we have fairly inclusive lists, and then can ask what happens if you choose a higher threshold. But in the case of Iraq, where all the debate's been recently, this isn't really an issue because I don't think anyone could argue that the tens of thousands killed in Iraq, possibly well over 100,000 in the last 3 years, wouldn't qualify. I mean, it makes it comparable to some of the most intense civil wars of the last 60 years.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the terms that has been applied to Iraq, particularly by the administration, is insurgency. This idea that, well, what we really have here is we have a situation where there is a kind of a duly constituted government, where we have people who are interested in trying to work together, form a government, have peace, move forward, and yet that there are organized armed groups that are interested in toppling that government, assuming taking power themselves. And certainly there are other places where that kind of situation is in effect. What is the difference between an insurgency and a civil war? Or again, here are we just making fine distinctions that perhaps to historians and political scientists are important, but in the real world maybe doesn't really make that much difference.
Well, I think it was really the administration and a lot of people in the press wanted to make a distinction, I think, between insurgency and civil war. I think it makes most sense to think of insurgency as a type of civil war, at least if it rises to the level in terms of the scale of violence that we call it a civil war. The term insurgency really starts to get applied in its current sense in the 50s and 60s, referring to communist insurgencies, mainly in Latin America and Asia. And it was referring then to a style of fighting by rebel groups and basically guerrilla tactics fought by kind of small units using hit-and-run tactics from rural base areas, but combined with a kind of political program of, along Maoist lines of mobilizing the people in support of the guerrilla effort. So I would view it as really kind of a style of fighting in civil war. Probably makes most sense. Mm.
So just to sort of draw a line under this major point, if I ask you the question, do you, based upon your study, your thinking about this, and what we generally know about what constitutes a civil war, if I said to you, is Iraq a civil war, your answer would be?
Certainly. Yeah. Yes, I think it definitely qualifies just under the basic notion that it's a violent conflict inside a country between organized groups fighting over political power.
Mm-hmm. If then we go a step further and say, well, if we've made the decision that it is, that it fits the definition, that it's consistent with other kinds of conflicts that we describe as civil war, then we can ask, well, what then? I mean, what do we know about how these conflicts play themselves out? And what you see is actually not terribly encouraging, I think, if you look at how long these conflicts take and how it is they end up being settled, that if you just ask the question, well, how long do civil wars go? There you can come up with an answer, and it tends to be longer if you look at wars like World War I and World War II, wars like that. That civil wars typically are much longer than those kinds of conflicts.
That's quite right. Civil wars since the end of World War II have tended to last on average about 10 years, with the median, or about half of civil wars ending within 7 years, and half ending in more than 7 years. So they tend to be quite long running, compared to interstate wars, which actually, I think, on average end in less than a year. They tend to be matters of months. But civil wars do tend to drag on, and a big part of that is because so many of the civil wars since World War II have been fought as guerrilla wars, which just tend to be very persistent and extremely difficult to end, it seems.
Mm-hmm. One other question, and then I have a caller here, our first caller I want to get to, so I want to promise that person I will not make them wait too much longer. One other basic question, then, that is, if you take a look at what the administration is talking about in Iraq, the hope is that there can be, to the conflict, whatever it is you call it, there can be some kind of negotiated settlement among the parties that will share power, share responsibility, share of the governing of the country. And your conclusion is that most of the time when you look at civil wars and ask how these wars end, that in most cases, civil wars don't end that way. They don't end with a negotiated settlement. They end when somebody wins.
That's right. About three-quarters of the civil wars that have been fought over controlling the center of the government, as opposed to a war of secession, end with a decisive military victory. Either the government crushes the rebels or the rebels actually take over the government. Power-sharing agreements have been much less common, occurring in maybe one in six cases, and I think that's a generous reading. Some of those power-sharing agreements are really one side basically won and offered some rather small concessions to the losers to bring them in. And then, a further, I think, concern about Iraq is that it doesn't look like it has the conditions that characterize those cases that did have successful power-sharing agreements. In particular, power sharing seems to be especially difficult to arrange if you've got very factionalized sides, and we've got a highly factionalized Sunni side and Shia side in the Iraq conflict. And they're also hard to arrange until the parties to a civil war have fought long enough to have seem to have come to the conclusion that they can't win by military means. And I think that maybe the central problem in Iraq right now is you've got armed groups on both sides who think that they can basically grab everything by military means if they keep at it, and especially if and when the U.S. Leaves.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is James Fraun. He's a professor of political science at Stanford University. And the question here we're talking about is this. Is it appropriate, does it fit, if we say that the conflict that's going on now in Iraq is a civil war? Is it or is it not a civil war? Something that's been debated quite a bit in Washington, I'm sure debated among scholars, debated among journalists. So there are some journalists who have come to the point where they've said, yes, we think it is and we're going to call it that. Others, not at that point. Perhaps yet. Questions are welcome. We have someone here ready to go on a cell phone, so we'll talk with them on line one.
Good morning, David.
Yes.
Good morning, Professor Fraun.
Morning.
I think there are a couple of things at issue here. One is the substance of the war. Another is the desire of the administration to manipulate language to avoid certain political consequences in a very Orwellian sort of fashion. But, I think that for people who ridiculed President Clinton for arguing about what the meaning of is, this is highly resonant. But at another level, I wonder if you could first of all comment on that, but beyond that, to decide whether this is merely an insurgency or a civil war, as if those were the two choices, I think is to simplify to simplify a complex situation, because we have at least two or three different kinds of wars going on at once in the same place. We have an internal civil war, but we also have an invasion, if you will, and occupation that makes it simultaneously an international war. And then the involvement of Iraq's neighbors, either explicitly or implicitly, in, you know, in the way that, for example, the British might have wanted to aid the CFA during the American Civil War, but with a number of outside actors trying to be involved, either through surrogates or directly. And I wonder if you could comment on that. I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Well, Professor Ferran, go ahead and you take that on any way you like.
Well, the caller makes some very good points. Let me talk about the complexity. It is a very complex conflict going on in Iraq. And in fact, you know, I've heard that used sometimes by administration spokesmen, sometimes by some people in the media, like Bill Keller, the editor at the New York Times, for saying why it isn't appropriate to call it a civil war. But I think a problem with that is it assumes that other civil wars are somehow less complex, and that's occasionally true. But a lot of the conflicts that we are quite happy, the media are quite happy to call civil wars, like say the Lebanese Civil War from 75 to 91. Show many of exactly the same sorts of complexity that we see in Iraq. So, for example, in Lebanon, there were a couple foreign invasions by Syria and Israel. For example, there was also a great deal of sectarian violence. More kind of communal conflict, revenge cycles that are kind of part and parcel to or stimulated by the larger political struggle. In general. Foreign intervention and foreign meddling in civil wars is extremely common and occurs in some significant way, and I'd say well over half of the conflicts that get described as meet the definitions for civil war in the last 60 years. So kind of this kind of complexity is quite general. I'm going to leave it at that.
Mm. What maybe I should ask that a more sort of basic question, and that question being, does it really matter what we say this is? One can understand how among academics you might discuss this and how it may to, for example, members of Congress, one side or the other, or the administration, it might be important to them what it is they can call this and what it is other people call it. But really, does it matter whether we call this a civil war or something else?
That's a great question. I have to say I've been kind of... I've been amazed by the attention that this, arguably semantic issue has gotten over the past few weeks. I guess, while saying that, I mean, particularly if you're on the ground in Iraq, a huge debate over whether it's a civil war or what probably might seem kind of absurd, I guess. But I guess at the same time we can point to certain ways in which it does matter. It's certainly one of those being for the way the discussion and the debate over the war is playing out in the United States, which can significantly, if indirectly, affect the course of the war there by affecting U.S. policy there. And then I guess the second way I'd say it can matter whether we call it a civil war. Is that if you accept that this is an event that fits in a category with others, then we can start to look at those as you were doing in some of your earlier questions for suggestions about what might happen in the future and what kind of policies would be best to pursue.
I suppose for particularly I think for the administration and for anybody who believes that we ought to continue to follow the kind of policy line that we have, this might matter. They might think that it matters because it what you call this might have some effect on public willingness to support continued U.S. involvement. If in that sense, do you think that that really matters? And if you look at past instances where there were things that that were conflicts where the United States somehow got involved militarily, do you think as far as people's willingness to say, yes, I think this is important for the United States to be there, I think it's important it's important enough so that I would say risking American lives or losing American lives matter. If it's a situation that clearly is defined as a civil war, do you think that make people less willing to say, well, the United States has some stake here? They might say, well, this is between those people. We shouldn't be there. We certainly shouldn't be risking American lives if we see it as primarily it's an internal conflict, something raging within one nation, and we don't have anything to do with that, really.
Right. Well, I think that my best guess as to why the administration is so concerned about it being described this way and has resisted it so strongly and for a long time was sending very strong signals to media outlets that they really thought it was inappropriate for them to describe it this way, is that concern that if it becomes popularly described as a civil war, then people will say, well, what are we doing in their civil war? That's their business, not ours. So I do think that's what they're worried about. There is some precedent for this. I mean, the Clinton administration in the first half of the 1990s argued against, and also the first Bush administration argued against involvement in Yugoslavia and the Bosnian conflict in particular by, in just these terms, saying it was a civil war, with all kinds of complexities that we couldn't understand or affect, and that was actually taken as a reason why we shouldn't get more involved for several years. On the other hand, we just intervened in Afghanistan, which had popular support, and we intervened in a civil war there. And the administration could well make the case that, fine, there's a civil war there, but nonetheless, the U.S. has really major interests and in the outcome of that civil war, and so we need to be involved.
Well, go on. We'll talk with someone else here. There's a caller in Belgium, the community, not too far away from here on our line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
The question that is coming to my mind is whether it's a civil war or not is really semantics. But the question I have is really, what started this civil war? Now, it seems to me this civil war was started by some actions that our government took. Now, if this really precipitated the civil war, doesn't that really put us in the same sort of league as Mr. Hussein, who went into Turkmenistan or wherever it was and killed all those Turkish folks? Or Kurdish, is that what it is? Kurdish, pardon me.
Kurdish. Yeah.
And we're trying him as a war criminal. Where does that really put us when you think about it? You know, if we cause this to happen, aren't we just as guilty as he is?
I guess I think that we deserve a huge amount of our government deserves a huge amount of blame, and the president in particular for making what has proved to be a terrible decision and what many people at the time expected would lead us to a situation like we have now. You raised the question, well, what started it? Basically, I think, what started the conflict there was the collapse of a central government that had, any ability to function. And we, were the main stimulus for collapsing the government by invading, putting the Saddam Hussein regime to flight, debathifying the administration, and disbanding the army. And that created a big power vacuum and contributed to the difficulties in putting back together a coherent government, and led to basically a situation of a very weak central government. One of the things we observe regularly, if you look at kind of what are the causes of civil wars over time, and certainly in the last 60 years, is that shocks to government capability, a collapse at the center, tends to lead to the kind of thing that we see in Iraq today. So I think we are indirectly responsible. I wouldn't put us in the same category. I think it's the moral question. We don't typically blame people for doing things that they do unintentionally, in the same way we blame on people for doing things intentionally. So intentionally gassing thousands of Kurds is a different category for blame than unintentionally causing a civil war. But I do think you're right that our government deserves an enormous amount of blame for doing something that they should have realized, and that, for example, the first Bush administration realized had a very high likelihood of producing very bad effects.
Well, that's the point I'm getting at, sir, is the fact that he had prior experience and people speaking to him that this was something you shouldn't do, and he willingly went ahead and did something that most people knew was going to go in this direction. That sounds like a criminal to me, sir. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. Just to talk just for a moment more about the significance of involvement of outside parties in civil wars. I think that this is something that the very first caller raised, and I think it's a point that's worth underscoring. And you've talked about it a little bit, but that is that it is quite common, in fact, in conflicts like this to see involvement of one or more outside parties, neighbors usually, but maybe not always neighbors, weighing in on the side of one or the other in the conflict. And that if you then ask this question, well, how is it things? Why is it that fighting stops? You said that fighting is likely to continue as long as the parties think that they're going to get where they want to go through force of arms. But often, apparently, it is the case that the fighting stops when outsiders that are aiding some of the combatants decide they're going to stop. Is that a generalization that generally holds true?
Yes, one of the things when you look at like how civil wars end, one of the kind of triggers is either the provision or withdrawal of support from a third state or set of states to one side or the other. You know, a good example would be the Lebanese civil war, where as part of a deal that the first Bush administration made with Syria concerning supporting us in the first Gulf War. They basically, the U.S. and Israel acquiesced to Syrian domination of Lebanon, and that led to a kind of a change in the balance of forces in Lebanon that ended the war. So, yes, that's right. And I guess whether the war in Iraq is going to last a really long time or not very long will depend probably a great deal on whether it goes in the direction of being armed on both sides and kind of along the Shia Sunni divide. So you have Iran backing Shia armed groups, and on the other side, Saudi Arabia, in particular, backing Sunni groups. If we see that, then I'd expect we would be in for potentially many years of fighting. Mm-hmm. So, I think it will really affect how long this conflict goes on.
But I suppose it's also true that if we could somehow magically get all outside parties out of this, get the United States out, the Syrians, the Iranians, anybody else, that doesn't necessarily mean the fighting would stop.
Right. I think another it would certainly settle down a lot sooner to a kind of lower level equilibrium where the killing is not as high as it is now. I think that'll happen in any event. But even without outside support, there's still some big obstacles to a power sharing agreement, and one of them being just how divided the Shia are internally and the Sunnis are internally. How can you write down on a piece of paper, here's our deal, when there are all these factions out there that you know on the other side are not going to abide by it.
Hmm. Just one more question. I think that now there are a lot of people who say that we need to start thinking about withdrawing U.S. troops, and perhaps the question simply is how many and how fast. And there are some people who were all the way over to one side of saying they'd say they should just all go tomorrow, and the other saying, no, that doesn't make any sense. That would only be chaos. The government would collapse without American support. And what we need to do is think about some kind of phased withdrawal over time. From what you say and what I understand you're saying about these kinds of conflicts is that it might not matter that much. Yes, I suppose there's a big difference between a phased withdrawal over a period of years and just pulling out all American troops at once. But it sounds as if the result of the American withdrawal, if it's significant, is almost going to be the same, and it doesn't really matter unless we're talking about an extreme case. It doesn't really matter how quickly that happens.
Well, I think it may matter for the total amount of killing that goes on. What I think it's probably not going to make a big difference for is the achievement of the political objectives that mm-hmm. the administration has. That is, I doubt, and this is based on the evidence we were talking about from other civil wars and the difficulty of you know, the rarity of successful power sharing agreements. I doubt that even if we were to increase our U.S. forces and try to, you know, in the best case, we could bring some temporary stability to Baghdad and tamp things down a little bit. But I fear that even if we got to that point, when we started to withdraw again, we'd see the same kind of problems, because the you know, getting some temporary stability that's guaranteed by our troop presence doesn't solve the basic problem of many factions that don't trust each other and don't have any particularly good reasons to trust each other, and many of which are also just interested in taking total control. So that's my concern, is that the political objective the administration has set is just fundamentally unrealistic, at least at this point. So that, yeah, it really is, you know, a question of do you withdraw quickly or slowly? And I think there's a difficult argument about, you know, rapid withdrawal may cause real spasms of violence that you'd want to avoid, and have people do what they're doing now, or have an opportunity to do more of what they're doing now, which is voting with their feet. Essentially, we're seeing Baghdad, we're starting to see a kind of Sunni-Shia line along the Tigris River develop, and it may be that U.S. troop presence is at least, or that the gradual withdrawal would be better to allow more time for people to sort themselves out somewhat less violently than might occur if we were to withdraw suddenly.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is James Ferran. He's professor of political science at Stanford University. He's a scholar who spent a lot of time studying the politics of civil war, has written extensively on the subject, has testified before Congress, and we're talking here about this very question about whether or not it is appropriate, correct, to say that the conflict that's going on now in Iraq is a civil war. And if we say that, what that means. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And we have a couple of callers here ready to go. Next, someone over in Indiana, Bloomington, Indiana, line one. Hello.
Hi. To continue the question you were just discussing, does the fighting stop if we Americans get out, or does it intensify? It seems to me that the terrorist attacks in Iraq are too indiscriminate to be a civil war. The goal seems just raw terror and chaos, and that, you know, with the intention of preventing control by civil authority, to prevent effective civil government. It's too indiscriminate to be a civil war. Just kill as many people, men, women, children, everybody. Clearly, it seems to me that the purpose must be to discourage us, U.S., from until we leave, because we are preventing the terrorists from owning Iraq. As the situation is, we Americans have a base in Iraq and a potential ally right in the terrorist heartland, in the Islamo-fascist heartland. We're there, and while we are there, we are really thwarting the Islamo-fascist conquest. They can't. So it seems to me what is happening in Iraq is not a civil war, but it's an attempt to discourage us.
No, Professor Ferran, what do you think?
Well, I guess I disagree on what, you know, what listeners might say is a semantic question in the end. But you know, I do think that certainly one of the aims of the insurgent groups on the Sunni side has been to compel U.S. withdrawal. Although that seems to be changing, or at least for a number of the groups that now see U.S. presence as desirable, in that it provides some shield against who they view as their real danger and the real enemy, which is Shiite domination. But even insofar as the idea is, for some of them, is to drive the U.S. out, the reason they want to do that is they want to take back power from the Shiite-dominated government. They simply do not accept the idea of an Iraq ruled predominantly by Shia, which is the necessary consequence of democracy in Iraq. Instead, they have a fairly explicit aim of bringing back a Saddam-like regime, you know, headed by a Sunni strongman. So I guess I agree that, you know, getting the U.S. out is a is an important objective for a number of the groups, including some on the Shia side, Sadrists, at least that's what they announce. But the point of that is exactly what you see in other, you know, what we call civil war, which is that they want to take power.
If it's a Sunni thrust, they certainly don't mind killing fellow Sunnis, do they?
No, and that's typical of civil wars. There's probably as much, or say in the Lebanese conflict, there was probably as much killing within the Muslim and Christian sides as there was across it. That's quite typical.
Thank you very much.
All right. Well, I was thinking about the caller's use of the word indiscriminate, because it does indeed seem that there is a sectarian dimension to this conflict, but there's also, in a sense, a factional dimension, and that doesn't necessarily mean limited to faction of Sunni versus Shia. It is within those sides that are fighting one another. There are people who are jockeying for power and for influence, so that it's kind of a free for all.
Yeah, I think one of the things that hasn't been reported enough, but that I'm worried we'll see developing is really an intra-Shiite war. I think that Muqtada al-Sadr in particular, one of the leaders of one Shiite faction, wants to be the next Saddam Hussein and the next ruler of Iraq. And we've already seen a fair number of skirmishes between Sadrist militias, some acting on Sadr's orders, some act freelancing with other Shiite groups. And particularly if we see the Sunnis pull out of the government completely, I would not be surprised to see the Shias kind of basically disintegrate into a war amongst themselves.
All right, let's talk with someone else. Charleston next, line two. Hello.
Just a quick comment, question, I guess, relative to the Belgium caller's point. Does your guest understand that Donald Rumsfeld cannot travel to Germany, and if he does, he'll be arrested as a war criminal?
Yes, I will. I mean, I know that he's under pressure on that because of the decision making on Abu Ghraib, and I hope it wasn't taken that I was defending or taking a strong position that's not appropriate. It could well be. Thank you.
All right, let's go next, line three. This is a caller in Champaign. Hello.
Morning.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if your guests would care to address an issue with respect to, like, perhaps how we got into this, and in general, I think that Colin Powell's idea that if you go in there, you'll be able to take over the army, but if you break it, you'll own it, and we broke it, and now we own it to some extent. If you'd focus on that. And then the role of big oil. I know it's sort of a shibboleth in considering these matters, but how much influence do you think the mindset, if not the actual interplay between big oil and the administration, had to do with our going in there? And what outcome do you think they have in mind, and do you think they have any influence in creating that outcome? And thank you.
All right. Well, I don't know if those are things that you feel that you can comment on or would want to comment on. You can take that on however you like.
The first one was the "you broke it, you own it" proposition.
Yeah.
Well, looks like that was quite right. That was what I was worried about, and I think what a lot of people were worried about, that we would just not be able to get out. That was what the first Bush administration was worried about in 1991, and that proved to be quite correct. If you go into a country, and it's basically the Vietnam problem all over again, that our military can be very good at fighting another military and defeating it, but the problem of reconstructing political order in a country where, you know, a central government is very weak, incompetent, corrupt, is not something that our military or our State Department it does well. It's not clear anyone really knows how to do that, and it leads to the problem of kind of no exit strategy. As big oil, I really don't see the evidence that there was any really direct or significant influence on the oil companies on the decision to invade Iraq. In fact, I've always found the argument a bit puzzling. I mean, clearly, you know, one of our major interests in the region in general is that it produces oil, and that's critical for our economy. But if all we really cared about were getting oil from Iraq, it's not clear to me why we would have had an embargo on Iraqi oil for much of the 90s. Or why the oil companies wouldn't have figured that, more or less what has happened, that, far from, increasing the flow of oil or their access to oil there, it's actually, Iraq is importing oil now.
Well, if we talked earlier about the fact that it in civil wars, it's really very common for outsiders to become involved, to weigh in on one side or the other that's fighting in the country. If you ask this question, why is it that, and I guess generally this ends up being neighboring countries, why is it that they do that? Does it have something to do with their interest in having a client state next door or a government next door that they can rely on or have some influence on? Is it sometimes the case that it has something to do with natural resources and neighbors wanting to have some kind of access to those resources?
That's a good question. It differs from case to case. I think probably the most common thing is just a security concern that states want to have their neighbors be countries that aren't hostile to them, that they aren't going to have to build up their military against to defend against. So, of course, Syria and Iran are interested in, have very strong interest in who's in power in Iraq. Iran fought an extremely bloody long war against Iraq under Saddam Hussein in the 1980s. And of course, for reasons like that, they would prefer to have a regime there that they have close ties to and feel they have a lot of influence over.
We have about 10 minutes left, actually perhaps a little bit less, maybe more like 7 or 8 minutes in this part of Focus. I'd just like to introduce again our guest, James Fraun. He's a professor of political science at Stanford University and has written a lot on the politics of civil wars. Questions certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Well, we're expecting here, I think tomorrow officially, there to be the release of the report of this group known as the Iraq Study Commission. Also, some people refer to it as the Baker Commission because it's chaired by the former Secretary of State. And so there's been a lot of speculation and I think also some little bit of leaking going on as to what it is that this commission might recommend. But I think that I'm not sure that anybody is expecting anything really earth-shakingly different, and perhaps for the kind of reasons that we've pointed to here is that we don't really have a whole lot of options, and it makes it sound as if, based on what you've said about conflicts, that we should expect every reason to expect this one to continue for at least the foreseeable future, that the idea of the kind of political settlement that we're talking about, this power-sharing settlement, is not very likely, because if we look at other similar conflicts, it just doesn't work. Your argument is, your contention is, that most of the time civil wars end when one side or the other achieves a military victory, not because they all sit down at the table and say, okay, how can we talk about this to settle things? And it also makes it sound like, you can have whatever kind of withdrawal plan for American forces that you want, but that there's got to be some connection between things getting worse and our leaving. It just makes it sound as if the United States has really no good choice here. Am I being overly pessimistic, do you think?
I wish you were, but I don't see. I mean, if there were some obvious course of action, we might not even see these all these different commissions and groups working on new policy recommendations. I mean, it's sometimes said that when you see government commissions being appointed to address a problem, there's really nothing that can be done. I think that the Baker-Hamilton, the Iraq Study Group, report. It seems like their, one of their principal concerns or issues has been to how to, on the one hand, how to come up with options that will not be so far from what the president has kind of dug himself in on, that it has some chance of being something the president feels he can embrace or move towards. How do they kind of thread the needle between, getting something that Bush will be able to embrace without it really looking like, oh, he's cutting and running. But on the other hand, it seems like I think the commission, doesn't see any great prospect of success if we continue on this course. So it seems to me they're engaged in a very, tricky, kind of trying to walk a tricky political line.
We have another caller here, someone who is up calling in somewhere up in the Chicago area, maybe west of Chicago on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes. Mm-hmm. They always say follow the money, and my feeling is that we've gone in there for Israel, and our benefit, certain people's benefit, not the United States' benefit. Israel, at least maybe 20 years ago, an Israeli diplomat stated on the air that Israel plans to become the center of commerce and industry in the Middle East. And that always stuck in my mind. And I feel that's a weakening. This would be a weakening of Iraq because they're a strong country. And I feel a lot of our actions are for the interest of Israel. And I think it's wrong. And I'm not an anti-Semite.
Well, again, I don't know, Professor Ferran, you want to comment on that at all?
I think, people in the U.S. say that we want to be a center of commerce and industry all the time, and we don't view that
as Israel.
I know, but I'm saying that if people in the U.S. say that, I don't imagine that we think of that as being a terrible objective. But on the question of what was the role of Israel in the decision to invade Iraq, I guess I think that when you look at there were a whole bunch of different agendas by different people in the Bush administration, and certainly some of the people viewed getting rid of Saddam Hussein and promoting at least superficially democratic government and preferably an actually democratic one there as a positive thing for Israel and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And you heard people talk about how the road to Jerusalem is through Baghdad, which has proven to be an incredibly silly proposition. But that was just one of multiple agendas, and I although I don't know that we'll ever know for sure, I really seriously doubt that that was really what was the decisive consideration for the guy who really made the decision, which was President Bush.
Yeah, again, I thank the caller for the comment. Just to finish up here, we're coming down, we have the last minute or two. You talked about the fact that it is uncommon, and if you take a look at previous conflicts, it is not likely that the kind of power-sharing agreement that we're sort of talking about is going to work. There, as long as combatants think that they can get what they want through force of arms, and as long as perhaps they don't trust the other side to keep whatever agreements that it makes. So that makes it seem that the settlement, a peaceful political settlement, it seems less likely than the fact that, as you say, in past conflicts, it generally ends when one side or the other wins military victory. One of the things that people have talked about is they have said that if we're really going to be realistic about this, what we should be thinking of is an actual division of the country into clear semi-autonomous states with the Kurds in the north and probably a relatively small section of the country that would be Sunni dominated and the rest Shia. Some kind of a federation of autonomous states. Have there been times when civil wars actually did end that way?
Yes, there have, and the most dramatic recent example might be Bosnia, which essentially ends with a de facto partition in 1995. I think that that's what we're seeing in Iraq now is de facto partition. The Kurds are already have quite autonomous regional government in the north, and it seems most, if not essentially all, Kurds would ideally like to have an independent state, but they realize that this is very problematic in terms of regional diplomacy and politics. And then what we're seeing in the south, much more tragically in terms of violence, is a de facto partition or at least separation of Sunni and Shiites as people move to escape persecution and violence. I don't think that the U.S. pushing partition, as some people have argued for, including a number of voices in Congress, is a good idea at all. I think it's actually a very bad idea. It may be that the Iraqis will come to the opinion that that's what they should do at some point, but I don't think it's at this point. It's not really our business to decide, whether to divide up Iraq into multiple states. To do so would confirm a very common view in the Arab world, which is that the reason things are going badly in Iraq is because it's deliberate. It's deliberate on the U.S.'s part rather than incompetence, but we're doing this because we want to keep Arabs down. And to partition would lead people to think, that would just confirm the view that what we wanted to do was divide up and keep the Arabs down. And also, just in practical terms, for us to, I can't imagine that we want to have U.S. troops knocking on people's doors and saying, move or else we'll have to shoot you.
Mm-hmm. Well, there we're going to have to stop because we've come to the end of the time. Our guest in this hour of the show, James Farron, he is a professor of political science at Stanford University. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.